All right, I'm not going to lie to you. I have been looking forward to this segment all week. This is very, very exciting to me. The 2015 revival of The Color Purple, the musical adapted from Alice Walker's novel, with book by Marsha Norman and music and lyrics by Brenda Russell, Allie Willis, and Stephen Bray, won the 2016 Tony Award for Best Revival of a Musical. The Broadway run ended in January of this year, and the national tour is now originating its multi-city run at Proctor's in Schenectady. With a soul-raising score of jazz, gospel, ragtime, and blues, The Color Purple gives an exhilarating new spirit to the Pulitzer Prize-winning story. Tony Award-winning director John Doyle joins us to tell us more. Doyle's Broadway credits include, in addition to The Color Purple, Sweeney Todd, starring Patti LuPone and Michael Cerveris, Company, A Catered Affair, and The Visit with Chita Rivera. And it is a great, great pleasure, and many others, by the way, and it's a great, great pleasure to welcome John Doyle to the roundtable. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
It's a great honor to have you on our program. I am a huge fan of your work. Here's what I was noticing last night as I was looking over your credits, that the things that I look at as just very meaningful, memorable experiences in a theater, that list, that rather small list, seems to coincide with your credits and what work you have done. Which brings me to the question of what lures you to a project to allow to put your touch on it. Many of these credits that I mentioned are revivals.
They are. Yes. I mean, that's not deliberate. Because of Sweeney Todd coming from Britain to this country and being very successful on Broadway, and I won the Tony and all those things, of course, inevitably that means you get asked to do more revivals. Following year, Company won the Tony for a revival, this and so on and so forth. I don't really start from that. I mean, something like, I start from the story. That's the first thing. So take something like The Color Purple. There were very many good reasons why I shouldn't direct The Color Purple, right? I'm a man, I'm British, I'm not getting any younger, and crucially, I'm white. And those things truly were a concern to me. And there, when I was asked, it was first made at the Chocolate Factory in London, which is a very tiny theatre.
Yes.
And when I was asked to do it there, I'd just done a Sondheim musical there, and they asked me on the opening night, would I do The Color Purple? And I said, you're crazy, you're out of your mind. But let me read the material, just to be polite. And I looked at the show, and I listened to the music, and I liked it very much. But I still wasn't absolutely sure that I should do it for all those reasons. And then I read the novel. And I thought, you know, if I could just, first of all, if I could honor Alice Walker, and if I could meet Alice Walker, you know, we all have our heroes in our lives.
Absolutely.
Then that would be a very special thing for me. And the other attraction of that story was I went to university in this country a very long time ago, in the early 70s. I went to the University of Georgia. And coming from Scotland, where you'll bear in mind that I had never, when I went to the University of Georgia, I had never met a person of color. There weren't any where I came from. So it wasn't a choice, it was a reality. And so to find myself all these years later telling a story that is about that culture in Georgia is very meaningful. But for me, it's the story first and foremost. And the other thing that it is the collaborators. Who's on the project with you? What can you do together? Those are the things that mean the most.
Having seen the original production, then having seen your production mm-hmm. on Broadway, there was you probably have better mm-hmm. terminology for this than I do, but there was a very much of a stripping down
yeah.
of the production, and it became spare.
Yeah.
And it allowed us into this world and to become and not to in any way say anything bad about the other production, which is
sure,
beautiful,
sure.
but it does allow you an intimacy and a moment with these incredible characters and have the emotion wash over you, but also permeate perhaps more than in another format.
Yeah. You know, I think that roots in my own taste, really. Many reviewers, I believe, I don't tend to read them much anymore, but many people who have written about what I do will say that I'm a minimalist. Yeah. Now, bear in mind, I come from the Highlands of Scotland. I was raised a Presbyterian. You know, you don't have a lot of kind of stuff around. You know, things are sparse in a way, beautiful but sparse. And so that's something that I bring to storytelling. And I think of myself as an essentialist rather than a minimalist. I mean, I like to put on the platform only that which is essential to how you access the audience's imagination. I think, you know, the movie industry is such a wonderful thing, movie making, because it can show you reality. And I think our job as theatre makers is to find ways of telling stories that are highly theatrical. Well, and the most theatrical thing is the audience's imagination. You know, how do you access the fact that we all go to the altar at the same time to watch a story, and how do the altar being the stage, as far as I'm concerned, and how do you bring to that the fact that everybody in that room wants to hear the story, and already in the case of The Color Purple has probably some knowledge of that story in their minds. So I didn't want to have trees and buildings coming floating on and off. I wanted to make a story that could almost look like it's happening on the porch of a house in a shack in Putnam County, Georgia. So it's told really with performers and some chairs. There is a set which I designed. You know,
yes.
It is big, if you like. There is imagery, there is lighting, it's theatrical, there's a band, everything. But push comes to shove, it's just told by actors. It's very, very actor-based theatre, who know that the audience are there, who sing to the audience. And when we were making it, I remember when we were making it in New York City, I thought in the rehearsal room, oh, this is going to be okay. It's all going to work. You know, you always have days of doubt, but it felt like it would work. I had no idea until I saw it in front of a Broadway audience, an American audience. I had no idea of the potent nature of the story to the American psyche, and the fact that people were coming as if they were coming like to good church, you know, I mean that in the best possible way. They were coming to celebrate this extraordinary story of somebody going from a very vulnerable place through to a kind of resurrection, as happens to this central character. And I didn't know that I would be in a theater where I would watch black people and white people together celebrate that story. That felt very, very important.
That idea that you just described, though, I don't want to be lost, of the characters really owning their own stories.
Yeah. You know, I think that's the most interesting thing about the theater. It is about humanity, about human beings. As if it has a future, and I do believe it still has a future, it's tough sometimes, but I do, then it is absolutely about connecting with the human spirit. I think now, more than ever, look at the events of this last few weeks, more than ever, we need to explore all that's good in humanity, all that's positive in humanity, all that can celebrate and shine in the end of the day. And I think that's what theatre can do. It can remind us a number of things. It can remind us fundamentally of our sameness. I always think theatre is the thing that shows us that we are the same, that we've all got a story to tell. We can all be Celie, or we can all be Mister, or we can all be Shug Avery, depending on which part of our day we're in, you know, in this story, or Sophia. We can be any of these characters, which is what makes the play kind of eternal in a way. But the glory lies in getting close to those people. And I think for whatever reason, that's what the production has done. But that's what I'm interested in. And that's why I decided to do it. And that you said in your very nice introduction, you know, a revival is not about a comparison to the first time. I don't set about some of the revivals that I've done. You know, I've followed great directors. I followed Hal Prince with Sweeney Todd, for God's sake. You know, that if anything was ever intimidating, that was. But I don't go into a rehearsal room thinking, how can I get rid of Gary Griffin's work, or how can I get rid of Hal Prince's work? No, I treat the piece as if it were new to me, because the revival, I think, sometimes has a sense to people of a copy of the past. I don't believe it should be a copy. I think it should be a new view, a new vision of what a piece can be.
You mentioned a moment ago about the importance for you of meeting Alice Walker and getting that approval. Mm-hmm. What was that process like?
Yeah, I don't know that I wanted approval, but I wanted to feel that I could honor what I read in the novel. You know, there's a tremendous relationship. But the novel, fundamentally, apart from the woman's journey, honors two things. It honors her relationship with her sister, which is probably the great love story of the piece, and her relationship with God, and how that breaks through the piece and refines itself. And those two things seemed very important to me. And I can remember now the day that, you know, we had a lot of people came to our rehearsal room in New York when we made this piece. Oprah Winfrey came, and, you know, it was lovely. But I can remember the day that Alice Walker came. She very quietly and gently came into the room. She sat beside me. She watched the first act very quietly. She smiled. She said a couple of words, and she left. And I thought, we're fine. And we came to opening night. And it came to that great big song that Seeley sings, I'm Here, near the end of the story. Right. And Alice was sitting directly behind me. And during that song, all I felt was a hand come on my shoulder. And it was Alice Walker's hand. I didn't need to read the reviews. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I didn't need that. It didn't matter to me that it won the Tony. Very nice that it did, right? But it didn't, or we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But that's not what mattered to me. What mattered to me was Alice Walker's hand on my shoulder. I felt that I had connected, bearing in mind that when I first came to America and went to the University of Georgia in the 70s, I got on a Greyhound bus from New York City to Athens, Georgia, because that's all I could afford to do. And I was the only white person on the bus. And I suddenly found, I was having a personal experience in doing that all those years ago as a 20-year-old man, of what it felt like to be the outsider, what it felt like to be the one that everybody looked at. And to take the journey of then actually directing The Color Purple on Broadway, you know, with Alice Walker in the room was remarkably special for all of that personal reason.
John Doyle is our guest. The Color Purple begins a national tour at Proctor's in Schenectady on October 7th. It runs through the 14th. Can I hold you for a few more minutes? Can we continue our conversation?
Sure.
Excellent. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with John Doyle and talk about The Color Purple running at Proctor's through the 14th, 7th through the 14th. And you can find out more by going to proctors.org. We'll be right back. It's Sunday! The Color Purple begins a national tour at Proctor's in Schenectady, New York on October 7th. It runs through the 14th. John Doyle directed the Broadway revival, and it is a great pleasure to have him in our studio live this morning. Thank you very much for staying with us.
My
so
pleasure.
In all of our conversation about your work on this show, we haven't talked about the music yet. Good God, the music. The glorious, glorious
it
music.
It is glorious. I mean, it's very interesting. The music, of course, was written by three people, as you listed earlier on, which is an unusual situation in musical theater. And fundamentally, songwriters, not musical theater writers, you know, popular songwriters. But they've tapped into, you know, gospel, jazz, the blues. They've tapped into a world that is very accessible to them. And it's great stuff. And the songs, you know, Marsha Norman has also done a great job with the book of you know, the book of a musical is so much the architecture for where a story sits.
Yes.
There are some really great ideas in the songs, too. Not only are they uplifting and moving, but there's something very powerful in them. And what was really exciting in the rehearsal period, first time around, and a little bit this time, too, is that they were completely open to change. You know, there was no sense, you know, people do say a musical's never really finished. They were completely open to, cut that bit or try something different here or what suits the actor, the performer who's doing it. Very special.
The original cast, I mean, obviously you have a new cast now that's working on this, but I do want to talk about this original cast because, I mean, you have Jennifer Hudson, you have Cynthia Erivo, and the talent that you were working with, I mean, that's just to name a few, the talent you're working with is extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. I mean, Cynthia I'd worked with in London, and really nobody knew who she was. And when it was decided that this would come to America, I said, well, look, I will do it, but only if you bring Cynthia with us, because I felt that she'd been in the room when I first made the work, and she mm-hmm. was really remarkable. And everybody, you know, inevitably, Broadway being what it is and the need to sell tickets, there was always that question of, well, nobody knows who she is. Well, they're glad they did it now, you know. A Tony and a Grammy and an Emmy later, everybody's quite happy about that one. then the interesting, very interesting mix of the three ladies who played Shug Avery. Jennifer Hudson, obviously iconic, wonderful girl. I mean, really a wonderful, wonderful human being. Was not a particularly experienced stage actor,
right.
But really worked so very, very hard. Heather Headley, who came in the middle,
right.
A goddess, right? Something else again. I would do anything with her anytime, Heather, if you're listening. Any idea you have, just extraordinary. And then to finish with Jennifer Holliday, who was really Dreamgirls, you know, was the first of those women to come, the African-American women, well, not the first, but one of the early ones to come in and belt those big songs and win a Tony. You felt that there was a kind of history, you know, going from the movie Effie to the stage Effie in the two Jennifers, with Heather in the middle, was really something. But they're all great. Danielle Brooks, who was in the original, who played Sophia, marvelous. But this company, what's been very nice is that the three covers of the three original leading ladies are all now playing the leads on the tour. Mm-hmm. I asked that we try to make that happen if we could, because I felt those girls had been all the way through the rehearsal period originally. They knew what it was. I'd seen them all do it at different times. Inevitably, it's a long run, so people, right. You see them go on. I knew they were terrific. And it's just great to see them have their moment. That felt very special.
So the process that goes on, I find this fascinating, of because the national tour is starting here in Schenectady.
Yes.
So you're tacking it. You're making
yes.
sure that it can fit in Cleveland.
Yes.
Yeah. And in Hartford and everywhere else.
Yeah.
And you started all in Schenectady. So you come in. Now, they've been working on this for a couple of weeks now. You come in this week, uh-huh. and what do you do? What's your job over
yeah,
the
sure,
next couple
sure,
days?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I also designed this piece, and I also did all the movements. So
right.
I've got a triple hat to wear. When a tour goes out, I did the same with Sweeney Todd. I said, look, you know, I will be in a mental home if I have to go in and start this all over again. This is
right.
not a good idea. But my associate, Matthew DiCarlo, who I trust implicitly as a great guy, I said, get him to get it back on its feet, which I knew he could do more than do that, because he'd been all the way through the process with me, so he could translate. He can be my voice in the room. And I went in and out of the rehearsal room in New York quite a number of times when it was being re-rehearsed, just to give some thoughts, add some ideas. That's my main function now, is to remind everybody of why the original choices were made, and also to look at it and see if we can make it better. Nothing's finished. See if we can actually, okay, I know it won a Tony, but let's see if we can actually make that bit more interesting or take it a little further. That's the main part of the job. It's a relief as a director to walk in and all the nasty bit of the technical rehearsals are over, you know. Any shouting that's happened has already happened, and you can go in for the last few days and make sure that the work is staying on track. And for me, importantly, bearing in mind that the piece originally started in a theatre that seated less than 200 people. Then it went to Broadway in a theatre that seated roughly 1,000. Well, not very many weeks from now, it's going to be playing The Fox in Atlanta, which has got about 4,000. You know, it's
right.
It's growing in terms of the rooms that it's playing in. My job is really to make sure that the work sustains its intimacy and its human connection, but at the same time fills those spaces. So that's the real developmental part of the journey.
One of our dear friends of this station is Tony Miola, who does mm-hmm. great work with the sound design, and not on this production, but I've had conversations with him of what it is like to take something that has been in
yes.
a smaller house and then bring it. Proctor's a beautiful, but
beautiful.
It's cavernous. I mean, it's a big, beautiful theater. It's
yes.
huge.
It is beautiful. I mean,
so you want to keep the intimacy, obviously, yeah. but you also want to keep that sound very pure.
You do. I mean, the tour sound is being done by a colleague of mine, Dan Schreier, who's done a lot of my work. He did Sweeney Todd on Broadway. In fact, I think he's done all my Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. So although he didn't, for various reasons, do this one, but I said, look, if we're going to do this tour, he should do it, because I totally trust him in terms of the kind of, you know, you can hear my own soft-spoken voice, right?
Right.
So I want some of that to continue into how it feels in the room, so that it has a warmth in how it feels in the room, so that it's not just blasted at you. I don't like going to musicals where it's so loud that I think, I don't actually know who's singing. You know, you look at the stage, think,
absolutely.
Where's that voice coming from? It has to, the voice, the oral sound has to stay with the human body, and he's as good as it gets. So that makes me very happy.
Okay, so I would be remiss, I would be derelict in my talk show host duty if I didn't ask you what you're working on next.
Well, absolutely. Next is I'm artistic director of a theater in New York City,
right.
Classic Stage. So next, I'm doing a new play by Terrence McNally, called Fire and Air, which is about the relationship between Diaghilev and Nijinsky. And then after that, I'm doing a revival of Carmen Jones, the African-American cast musical written by Hammerstein and Bizet. It hasn't had a revival for a very long time. So that's the one after next.
Is that Broadway bound?
I don't know. I mean, I never think of anything as being Broadway bound. You know, life is too full of nonsense to believe that anything is ever going to work out the way it could or should.
But it's not a bad thing if it happens.
It's not a bad thing. That's really sort of somebody else's choice, you know. It's nice if it happens. Yeah, sure, me doing a revival. Sure, they're going to think, oh, is this for Broadway? For the moment, it's for a small room at Classic Stage on 13th Street in New York City.
And in either way, no matter what happens, you still have the gig.
Doesn't matter. You're still telling the story. You're still alive. That's all that matters.
John Doyle, as I said, some of my most memorable and beautiful moments sitting in a theater have been watching your work. It is a great honor and a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I wish you all the luck in the world with this production and the future work as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. The Color Purple begins a national tour at Proctor's in Schenectady on October 7th. It runs through the 14th. To learn more, Proctor's.org. That link will be posted along with this interview at WAMC.org/roundtable. And again, a big thanks to John Doyle.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.